do you have any phobias? Most folk are scared of one thing or another, and that's a perfectly normal situation to be in. I have both family members and friends who have their own phobias, my wife being one of them. If there's one thing my wife absolutely hates, it's flying, which is quite unfortunate because to get anywhere nice and sunny, you have to fly, and she often comes with me when I'm on a trip somewhere, and for her, flying, particularly the takeoff and landing, she finds utterly terrifying. Now, we've just come back from Poland, and I normally sit next to her so she can squeeze my hand, or pulverize my hand more like, as she squeezes in fear as the plane begins to take off. But we took Ryanair, mistake in and of itself. And when you go as a group with Ryanair, you have to pay extra money to sit as a group. And of course, I mean. So we didn't pay the money. We are all spread out. My hand survived. And my wife had to go through the terror of takeoff and landing all by herself. But she's a big, brave girl, and she managed to do so. She was fine. It was, however, the smoothest two flights we have ever had. The last time I went away on, was for holiday. And in one fell swoop, flying over the Mediterranean, we hit one of those vacuum pockets where the plane dropped about 2,000 feet in the space of 10 seconds. And the screams in the plane were matched only by the agony of me screaming as she nearly broke my hand in two. So that's her phobia. Other folk have different kinds of phobias. Take this one for a phobia. How many of you really love spiders? I grew up in Africa, so they don't bother me too much, although I took my whole family out to Tanzania in 2008. And we bought a very well-known East African spray called Doom that promises to kill anything on sight. And a baboon spider crept out from under one of the chairs one night. My daughter and I were watching a bit of TV on our laptop. And this thing, it was about that size. And they're very territorial. Began running towards us. So I grabbed the Doom and began to spray. And it didn't stop in its tracks at all. So I began running around the room like a scared kid. My daughter on the settee screaming wildly. As this thing continued to chase me, and I'm running behind trying to spray the thing with Doom. I got through the entire can of Doom, which almost gassed me to death. Carries had to open all the windows and the door and all the rest of it. And eventually, when my tin had all run out, the thing finally keeled over. 15 minutes later, with stains all over the floor of Doom being sprayed. The house has never recovered since. I'm not hugely fond of spiders, but they don't bother me. It's not exactly a phobia. Here's another phobia that some people have. Birds. My PA hates birds, and I made the mistake one time. We were on holiday with the McPhees in Florida years ago, and we went to one of these Disney shows in one of the Disney parks, and the grand finale of this show was they got a huge big eagle, and the guy up on the stage released the eagle, and a guy who happened, I didn't know this beforehand, to be right behind us in the very back row would catch the thing and it'd swoop over everyone's head and you could feel the rush of wind in your head as this eagle swooped over and my PA almost keeled over because she utterly, utterly loathes birds. So if you're ever by the seaside, never throw out bread to the seagulls because some folk just don't like them all swooping around. Now, in the ancient world, they had their phobias as well, as we have our phobias. But actually, in those days, pre-technology, pre-medical intervention, there were three great fears that utterly dominated life in a way that we could never imagine here in the West. Now, I grew up in Ethiopia, and I can imagine it because I grew up in this kind of a society, particularly when we lived in northern Ethiopia in a very remote desert village. But three things would terrify people, and that was demons, disease, death. Now, why? Well, in the kind of culture in which Jesus lived, in the culture I grew up in, witchcraft was not uncommon. And therefore, occultic practices and demon possession was not all that uncommon. Jesus came across lots of people who were possessed by demons, and it's a horrible thing to see. I don't know if any of you have ever seen it in the flesh. I encountered something like this in a glow team last year in Hungary when we were doing some work in a gypsy village. And one young man came up to me to ask for prayer after I'd preached in the open air. And since his teens had been praying to demons that they would make him wealthy. And it led to all kinds of occultic manifestations, and praying over him, it was a scary thing to do. It really was, for reasons that I won't go into. But that was common in Jesus' day, and people felt, we have no control over this. What can you do if you experience somebody who's got demon possession? And then there's disease, which we have disease here, and it's terrible, but think of the blessing of the NHS. I've got a doctor's appointment, a specialist appointment, on Tuesday morning. I've got another one on the 6th of June for two different issues that I'm dealing with. And I will get world-class expert treatment, and I won't pay a penny. It's amazing. But imagine growing up in a culture where there is no medical intervention. And back then, even if you had money, doctors don't know how to deal with even simple stuff. Where if you, for example, get a dose of diarrhea and vomiting, which for us is inconvenient, but no big deal, you could actually die from it. You either get better because your body healed itself, or you just get sicker and sicker and more emaciated, more dehydrated and weak, and then you're finished. That is reality. That was the norm for people like that. Disease was terrifying. And even beginning at a childhood where we do have infant mortality in this country, about 4 people in every 1,000. In biblical times, it was about 30%. You have big families, you'll aim for 15 children because 5 of them will perish even before they're 3 months old. And then you work through life, and there were folk who lived till their 70s in Jesus' day, but by the law of averages, by the time you get to 70, half of your village has been wiped out from some illness or another. And then the stark reality of death, which we can do nothing about in our culture either, but if you live in a community where death is so prevalent, and where of your 14 siblings, by the time you reach the age of 40, half of them are no longer there. The smell of death is everywhere present. It is. Shadow's always there. It is terrifying. Now, that was Jesus' world. And what we have in this passage is Jesus, in an incredible way, dealing with the great fears that everybody was terrified of, rich or poor. And the whole thing starts in verse 18 where a man comes to Jesus, and we're told a little bit more about this man from some of the other Gospels who also relate the same story. This man is the leader of the local synagogue, at least in his village, he's the leader of the local synagogue, which probably means he was a relatively wealthy man who put up the cash that was necessary to build the synagogue. But he's also a community leader, somebody who's greatly respected and admired, and certainly somebody who believes in God. And he comes to Jesus and says, my daughter's died. Now, the crowd listening would have felt immediate sympathy. That's terrible. And they all would have had their own stories, maybe from their own family or from other families, certainly in their village, of families who have lost a young daughter or a young son. That was so commonplace. Everybody's been touched in that way. Why is he saying this to Jesus, other than getting a bit of sympathy from Jesus? But notice, this man is thinking quite differently. He's not looking for sympathy at all. He's looking for transformation. Because he says in verse 18, even if you will touch her, reach out your hand and touch her, she will live again. That's an astonishing thing to say. Especially when, if he's a family man, he'll have seen death so often, and he knows that death is, well, it's permanent. There is no coming back. So what an incredible statement. Even if you touch her, she will come to life again. And so Jesus agrees to go, and they begin to make their way through this crowd, people crowding in on him, and in that crowd, there's a woman. And again, we learn a bit more about her from the other Gospels. And she is utterly distraught. And it's because she has had internal bleeding for a decade and more. And she had some money. But she would go to different specialists, and they would cost money. Any medical intervention back then would cost money. There was no NHS, but that medical intervention was very limited. And she spent all that she had, every penny, on doctors, going from one village to the next, trying to find any doctor who could try and treat her for her condition, but no joy. She gets the brightest experts, they can't help her. And she continues to bleed and continues to feel weak and emaciated and struggling every day. And worse than that, in Jewish culture, if you have a long-standing disease, you become religiously polluted. You can't go to church because you're impure, you're unclean. And worse again, you can't touch anybody, because if you touch somebody else, the uncleanliness from your disease affects them too, so they can't go to church either until they offer prayers and get forgiven and get cleansed, and only then can they go to church. So she's socially isolated. Can you imagine going for a decade with nobody giving you a hug? That'll be awful. But nobody can, because they'll be tainted. They'll be made unclean. But her faith, too, is remarkable. We get an insight into her mindset. She knows she can't ask Jesus to lay hands on her, even though he will go and lay hands on this girl. She can't ask that because she doesn't want Jesus, the rabbi, to become tainted. But she thinks, if only I can just reach out quietly as he's walking past, and I'll just grab the end of his cloak. He won't feel a thing. He won't know that I've touched him. But he'll heal me. Now, in the other Gospels, they tell us that Jesus noticed that power had left him. And he asked the question, who touched me? And the disciples said, Jesus, what do you mean, who touched you? Everybody's bumping into you. We're walking through a crowd here. But it was a different kind of touch, because Jesus knew that power had left him. And he turned to look and see, and the woman fessed up. It was me. I'm sorry. She was apologetic. Notice what Jesus said? Your faith has healed you. And she knew she was healed. After so many doctors and specialists, after so much help that wasn't a help because it made no difference at all, she suddenly healed. Then Jesus continues to make his way towards this house, and I need to keep going, because that's exactly how Matthew writes this passage. And they come to the house, and the house is full of mourners. And in some of these cultures, not unlike the culture that I grew up in, we don't hold ourselves back at funerals. We talk in the UK about having the kind of British stiff upper lip, which I don't think is entirely healthy, where we repress all our emotions, and it means that our emotions can stay with us for a long, long time. If you come to another Ethiopian funeral, you will hear wailing and screaming and shouting, and tears are flowing, and it's noisy, it's energetic, because people are giving vent to the emotions which they genuinely feel, because losing somebody is heartbreaking. And they let it out. Same in Jesus' culture. And they would hire professional musicians who would come and lead the music. It was to whip up that sense of emotion, to have that emotional release. They're professionally hired musicians, a praise band, just to let it go. And so Jesus walks into this incredibly noisy house with people howling and wailing. And he turns to the hired praise band and says, just go away. Just go away. Because she's not dead, she's only sleeping. And people laughed. And no wonder. It wasn't that what he said was funny, it was just stupid, frankly. You know the difference between somebody who's just asleep and somebody who's actually drifted off over into eternity. It's massive. I used to work as a nurse years ago, and you just know. And as if the folk would say, Jesus, are you serious? Do you think we haven't checked properly and shaken her and shouted at her? Of course we have. But sleeping and death are two entirely different things. And she is dead. And they laughed with derision. But Jesus wasn't put off. He walked into the room where the girl was. And he took her by the hand. And the other Gospels tell us he spoke to her. And just said, get up. And she did. She got up. Nobody could believe, can this be true? Are we seeing this? But her world changed, as did everybody else's. And then Jesus leaves that house because he's got a busy day, lots to do today. And as he tries to leave the village, he's confronted by two other people. And this time it's two guys, thank you, Colin, two guys who are blind. And they come to Jesus. I don't know how they got to. Maybe they followed the sound of all the crowds that are following Jesus, because the excitement is absolutely fever pitch by now. So even though they can't see, they can just follow the sound. And they shout out above the din of the crowd, Jesus, have mercy on us. Jesus, have mercy on us. And Jesus stops. And he turns to them. And he says something really quite pointed. He says, do you believe I can do this? Now, sometimes statements with no context are difficult to make out, but not for these guys. You see, he reads their minds. He knows what hope is in their hearts. What is the big issue they're struggling with? They can't see a thing. Now, I'm slowly losing my sight. It's getting worse and worse. Every couple of years, I have to get a new prescription because I'm blind as a bat. But these guys could see nothing. I at least can see most of you. Those of you in the back row, doesn't matter what you look like, I can't see you anyway. And now even the front row, terrible. These guys couldn't even see light. I once asked a blind friend of mine, what is the worst question that anybody's ever asked you? He said, well, a friend of mine once said to me, do you see those lovely red flowers? They were just having a casual conversation. And he said, well, first of all, I've never seen anything. And secondly, what is red? Means nothing. Means nothing. The isolation that blindness brings. Do you believe I can do this? Do you think I can make you see something you have never, never done before? And without missing a heartbeat, they said, yes. Astonishing. How did they know? We don't know. Had they met Jesus before? Had they heard about him before? We have no idea, but he was trying to smoke them out. What do you really believe about me, about this kingdom that I'm establishing? What do you really believe? Verse 29, according to your faith, let it be done to you. Like that they could see. Astonishing. Disease, death. And no sooner had this miracle finished when some friends brought another man to Jesus and he was demon-possessed. I've already mentioned to you my experience in Hungary with this young gypsy guy who I prayed over who had problems of demon possession. And this particular individual was so under the control of these evil spirits, couldn't speak. Can you imagine the frustration, not just for him, but for his family? Presumably his parents or his spouse, if he had one, had heard his voice in the past, but not now. Tongue-tied. And Jesus cast out the demon, and immediately the guy began to speak. Now that was Sunday. Don't you ever wish you could be a fly on the wall? You could get a Doctor Who time machine and go back in history and see Jesus in operation. But we come to the end of this chapter, and Matthew makes two very profound points that I want you to think about when you go home after church. And I want you to think about it when you go to work this week as well, or when you speak to your neighbors or your friends. Two profound things. First of all, in verse 35, he gives a kind of a statement summary of what Jesus was all about. Verse 35, Jesus went through all the towns and villages, teaching in their synagogues, proclaiming the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness. Matthew is telling us something about the nature of this kingdom. It's a kingdom of power. Why? Because Jesus is the king and he can do anything. The question, of course, is, do we believe it? You've been doing this series on identity, and what you think, what you believe about yourself, about your faith, about who you are as a Christian, who you are as a member of God's kingdom, will determine how you live. It all begins with your worldview, with your belief system. That governs everything. And as you look at these stories, they are not random stories, and neither are the statements which Matthew records random statements. These gospel writers were very thoughtful as they recorded this history. Notice the thing that all of these people had in common. Number one, they had a massive issue. Demons, disease, death, the three great fears, the three great burdens, massive issues. But secondly, they all believe that Jesus can transform our world. Now, how Jesus chooses to do transformation is up to him. And Matthew is not claiming that automatically within this kingdom there is, for example, healing on demand, but there is transformation. Jesus does make a difference. The question is, do we believe it? Do you believe that Jesus really is king? That this genuinely is a kingdom of power? Now, you're all, I presume, good evangelicals, so you say, oh, yes, yes. But we can say yes very easily, can't we? But without necessarily having a deep and profound conviction. Conviction like that ruler who, even though he knew his daughter was genuinely dead, he believed that Jesus, if he chose to, could make a difference. Or like that woman who had been to every expert she could find and could not find any help, she believed that where the experts fail, Jesus can succeed. Or like those blind men who had not been able to see a thing. They believed that Jesus could open their eyes and help them to see and to understand the world round about them. Do you have that kind of conviction? Is that the kingdom that you've joined as a Christian? Is that the nature of your Christian faith? I ask you that because it will affect every day of your life. What do you really believe? The truth is that tragedy, hurts, challenge affect all of us. I look at my own family, my own kids, my own situation. All kinds of challenges. I got a text last night from my brother. We were out celebrating my daughter's graduation, and he saw our Facebook postings. And he messaged me, both to congratulate my daughter, but also to remind me that it was 2 years ago yesterday that his wife, my sister-in-law, died. brain tumor. The first operation of which she had 1 week after they got married. Indeed, they got married quickly when they discovered that she had this tennis ball-sized tumor in her brain. She believed in Jesus and did know that Jesus could heal her, but also wanted to be subject to God's will and ask Jesus in very simple terms, Lord, if you want to heal me, then heal me. If your will is for me to be with you soon, then let me be with you soon, but give me a victory as I die. I had the immense privilege of flying over to the south of England where they lived on a number of occasions to see her. She got weaker and weaker and weaker. But you know what never left her? Her smile. Her joy. Her laughter. Her enthusiasm. And every day when I'd go and see her, she would say, I could be in heaven very soon. And she'd say it with a smile. Victory. Because she believed in a Jesus who is all-powerful, who could give us strength and change our world and change our situation and bring transformation even under the darkest shadow. And every day around the world, people are experiencing that. That's what this kingdom is all about. And some also get healed as well, miraculously. That's also what this kingdom is all about. It's a kingdom of power. Now, how do you see yourself as a Christian? Does being a Christian just mean for you that you believe a series of propositional statements about theology? Now, it does involve theology, and I think theology is very important. But it's not just assenting to some propositional truths. Neither is it just admiring a man like Jesus, who was the supreme moral example, though he was that. Neither is it just about community and loving one another, though he's taught us to do that too. This is also a kingdom of power. And we, as followers of Jesus, as Christians, part of our identity is to be people of power. Because Jesus is our King, and he has all power. Now, allow that to invade your mindset. Because it's part of the identity that we need to embrace as Christians. And around the world, believers are doing that. I was in Poland, as I said, with my wife just last week, and I met a young guy who had a huge crisis. And I deal with people all the time with crises in their lives. His particular crisis was profound, deep drug addiction. And his body even now is covered not just in tattoos, but in the scars of his own self-harming, tortured mind. And 5 years ago, he met Jesus, believing that even though his life was utterly, utterly desperate and there was no hope and nobody could help him, and he'd been through all those rehab programs and nothing worked, suddenly he met Jesus. And his life has never been the same since. Transformed. And he spends his time now traveling around Europe, meeting people in the most desperate situation and telling them, you can have hope because King Jesus has power. Isn't that wonderful? What about you? I don't know your faces, your background. You could be facing all kinds of crises now. Your marriage could be in bits. It might be that you and your partner, husband or wife, have considered separating. Maybe you've already made that decision because you just can't go on like this. Christ's power. You might have real issues with your own family circle. I have. And at times you cry yourself to sleep at night with the desperation of all of that. Jesus can help and strengthen and transform. Maybe you're battling worries. I have a friend of mine who I've spent a lot of time with in pastoral care, and he is being bullied in his workplace. It's gone on for years, and he is falling apart. I've had to deal with that an awful lot, an increasing amount, actually, in pastoral contexts. I've had folk who have phoned me from their stationery cupboard at work, terrified, just wanting to hear a comforting voice because they're broken. And he knows he needs to be courageous and to be a witness and to stand up for what's right, but he's just terrified. He has melted as a human being, utterly distraught, struggling now with depression and all kinds of challenges. Christ is real and can strengthen and help and transform and make that difference. The challenge for us is, do we believe that this is a kingdom of power? And do we believe in the power of King Jesus? If we do, that will transform your week. And those metaphorical demons that haunt you will become shadows as you cling to Christ. And then look how the passage ends. Jesus himself said, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Europe itself is the darkest part of our world, spiritually speaking. Where I grew up in sub-Saharan Africa, it's full of Christians, and it's being transformed as we speak. If you were to go to a country like anywhere in the Balkans, a capital like Ljubljana, you'd have less chance of bumping into a Christian there than you would if you walked through the streets of Saudi Arabia, because there are proportionately more believers there. We live in the most desperate continent on the face of the earth, spiritually speaking. And this dying continent of ours needs hope. And we've got a message of hope. King Jesus can transform. He can bring light where there's darkness. He can transform situations that seem hopeless. And the workers are few. Starting with your workplace. Or your neighbors. Or your family, if they don't know Jesus. Or your social circle. Every Tuesday night, I play football with a group of guys, none of whom do church. And for so many of them, their lives are utterly, utterly devoid of hope. King Jesus makes a difference, and his kingdom can invade their lives and transform. But the workers are few. Not only will your week be different, but if you really believe in the identity of this kingdom of power, your workplace, your social circle, your neighborhood can be different too as you bring this message of hope. But it all depends if you believe it or not. And that's the question. A whole lot of folk in this chapter, they all faced the most overwhelming challenges. But they all believe in the power of Jesus. I wonder, do you? Let me just pray. And pray that his kingdom will invade all of our lives. And we will embody this power daily as we live for him. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, we enthrone you and recognize that you have power to make a difference. And many of us, as we sit here, we have such struggles, such heartache, such brokenness. And we call out to you, Jesus, be real to us. meet us at the point of our need. Be there for us. Help us. May your power transform our outlook. May you come into our lives with such real power and make the difference that we need you to be. And then make us agents of change in our community, in our family, in our workplace, in our society, as we stand for the values of your kingdom and proclaim it to people round about us who have no hope. May we have that power invasion for Jesus' glory and the sake of his kingdom. Amen.